I'm continually amazed at how diverse these people were that interacted with one another at the time of the Reformation, and that they, you know, that they didn't do anything more than lose their temper like Luther and Caiaphas did. Staupitz was a very intelligent man and an excellent organizer with great political connections, and with the exception of the Luther matter, fantastically good political instincts. You know, he just didn't make wrong political moves. You know, if you can view church history as politics, which I think one probably ought to, you take a man like Cardinal Caiaphas, who may very well have been the most highly educated man of his age. Not the most brilliant, but certainly the most highly educated, the most erudite. And the guy we have today was a very obvious genius. You know, a genius, maybe the greatest genius that ever lived in terms of potential, Philip Melanchthon. And it's curious to see what happens to people. It takes more than extremely high IQ to be successful. And the last thing I will tell you today is that Melanchthon died a lonely and bitter man. And of the five people that we're talking about, really the only guy that died with a smile on his face was Luther. The five that I'm talking about this week, they weren't happy when they died. Well, Philip Melanchthon. Philip Melanchthon has kind of a bad reputation among Lutherans. Some of it's deserved, some of it is not deserved. And it's surprising what Lutherans don't know about Philip Melanchthon. If you would take a look at Melanchthon's writings, the critical edition, or what comes closest to being the critical edition of the writings of Philip Melanchthon, is a collection called Corpus Reformatorum, the Body of the Reformation. And it's a collection of books that are maybe about yay long, about a little bit longer than Thomas's Summa. And about a little more than half of it is the writings of Philip Melanchthon, and the rest are the writings of John Calvin. And they're in the original Latin, because virtually everything Melanchthon wrote was in Latin. And the tremendous versatility that the man had. I recall some years ago, I was talking one day to the book editor of Concordia Publishing House in St. Louis, about 6 months before he went to Augsburg. And he was looking around for books to publish, and he was pushing me a little bit, would I be interested in doing some translating from Latin and English, or German and English, of some classics. And I said, not really, but what I would like to do someday would be to pick out certain writings that I thought were significant by Philip Melanchthon and translate them into English. And he said, yeah, but I'm afraid Concordia Publishing House wouldn't be interested. You know, and I doubt whether Augsburg would be interested either. Very unlikely Fortress Press would be. But there are a number of things which he wrote which are well worth reading. I recall one time when I was quite interested in Melanchthon, I was reading a lot of the things that he had written, partly because I was doing my master's dissertation on Thomas Aquinas and Melanchthon on the notion of law. So I was reading around a lot in Melanchthon. And I just happened to run across his speech, which he delivered when he became a professor at the University of Wittenberg. Now, it used to be the custom, and it may still be at European University, but it used to be the custom that when you became a professor, you know, a real professor at a university, a dinner was given in your honor, and you were expected to deliver an inaugural address, which would be a learned address. And Melanchthon's address was entitled On the Idea of a University, a topic which has probably been used 1,000 times since. But as far as I know, Melanchthon was the first one to ever talk on the topic, and as a 21-year-old, green as grass, new prophet, Wittenberg University, he delivered a brilliantly conceived lecture on what a university ought to be like. And he was interested in that sort of thing for the rest of his life. I think one of the unfortunate things about Melanchthon's life is that Melanchthon was a natural-born university president or state superintendent of education or something like that. He was just born to establish educational systems. And he did do some of it. But he got involved in other kinds of things which he wasn't quite that successful. But at any rate, his family, he was born of a German family. His name was Schwarzerd, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z-E-R-D, which if you translate it to English, it would be Black Earth. You know, like the town up in Minnesota. Black Earth, family's name, Schwarzerd. He was born on the 16th of February, 1497. So he was 14 years younger than Luther. All the guys so far we've talked about were older than Luther. He was younger than Luther, and Emperor Charles V was younger than Luther. February 16th, 1497. He was born at Breton in the Palatinate. Now the Palatinate was the western area of the German-speaking peoples. It was one of the territories, clearly acknowledged territories of the Holy Roman Empire, and it was in the area around the Upper Rhine River. So it was quite a distance from where Luther lived. His father's name was George, and he was armorer to the Emperor Maximilian. He was, in other words, he was in charge of munitions and weaponry for the army. His mother's name was Barbara, and her maiden name was Reuter, R-E-U-T-E-R. So if any of you have any Reuters in your background, you may be related to Philip Melanchthon, because Reuter is a very common German name. It was a very prominent family, as you may expect. His father died in 1508 when Philip was 11 years old. Philip and his brother George were taken to Pforzheim, which was a distinguished school. Interestingly enough, it's also the school which Friedrich Nietzsche attended when he was a young boy in the early 1900s. This was one of the outstanding children's schools in Germany. Very early in life, he showed great promise of genius. His great uncle, Johann Reuchlin, who was one of the leading humanists of the time, as I told you the other day, took a personal interest in his education because he was so bright. And it was he who translated his name into Greek. The Greek word for black is melon, and the word for earth is chthonos. So he renamed him Melanchthonus. And that's how he got his name, Philip Melanchthon. So he gave him a classical version of his name. Instead of a vernacular name, Schwarzert, he now has a classical name, Melanchthon, you know, and it has a classical ring to it. He attended Heidelberg University between 1509 and 1511. He entered Heidelberg University age 12. And he left there with the BA in 1511 at age 14. It was not a very good university. It was certainly not as good as it is today. But at the time, it was a rather poor university, but regardless, he got his BA there. And because it was a poor university, and apparently because it didn't begin to be challenging to him, even though he was only 14, he transferred to Tübingen University, which was a much better university. And he received his master's degree there in 1514 when he was 16, almost 17. One of the professors whom he had there was a professor of astronomy. And he was particularly interested in astronomy, which is kind of interesting because virtually the rest of his education was in the classics. And so he got an arts education. And this was about the only science he got was astronomy. Well, his prof was also interested in astrology. And he developed an interest in astrology in Melanchthon, which lasted for the rest of his life. He always had a kind of a curiosity about astrology, which is kind of strange. On the university level, he studied Latin, Greek, Hebrew, philosophy, literature, poetry, medicine, history, astrology, astronomy, and theology. By the time he received his master's degree, Erasmus, who was the most well-known scholar of the time, had heard of him and was corresponding with him. And this correspondence and friendship continued for the rest of his life. After he received his master's degree from Tübingen, and bear in mind that the master's is the terminal liberal arts degree at the time, he taught at Tübingen for 4 years. As a member of the humanities department. While he was there, he taught Virgil's Aeneid and Virgil's Eclogues and the other poetry of Virgil, the plays of Terence, Cicero's orations, and the poetry of Livy. He apparently was also studying Aristotle in the original Greek, and got quite interested in Aristotle, and this Aristotelian interest will show itself later on in certain interesting and sort of tragic kind of ways. But he was, he thought that he would like to produce a critical edition of Aristotle, put out a critical edition of Aristotle in the Greek. As a matter of fact, the first critical edition of Aristotle in the Greek was done in the late 19th century by Oxford University Press. And there wasn't any done until then, but he wanted to. Now bear in mind that this is the age that is just rediscovering classical and New Testament Greek and Hebrew. For better than 1,000 years, the church has known only Latin. Western Church and has been unable to handle Greek or Hebrew, and under the influence of Erasmus and Reuchlin, who was a classical languages prof, one of the emphases of the day is read it in the original and get it right. Don't take secondhand translations. Melanchthon has a natural affinity for both Greek and Hebrew. One would have expected him to have put out the German Bible, not Luther, but he didn't. But he's quite interested in Aristotle, and he wanted to put out a critical edition. He wrote rather interesting commentaries on most of the works of Aristotle, which have, to my knowledge, never been translated out of the original Latin. The first book that he did publish, he published in 1516, the year before, you know, the 95 Theses. 1516, when he was 19 years old, and it was the Complete Comedies of Terence. The second book which he published the next year was a book on Plutarch and Plutarch's Lives. The third book which he published in May 1518 was a Greek grammar, classical Greek grammar. Of course, by then he was getting old. He was 20 years old, 21 years old. He must have had some time while he was a university student, because he moonlighted as a proofreader in a print shop at the university. And so as a result, because of his job, he got to read the first edition of some of the great works that were being written at that time, because he'd read them in proof. So he didn't have to buy books. Well, at this time, Wittenberg University was looking for a prof to teach Greek and perhaps Hebrew also, because this was the new thing. Prior to this time, you know, nobody studied languages. Everything was in Latin. Now it's read it in the original, get it right, and so you got to have a prof on your faculty who teaches the students how to read Greek and how to read Hebrew and how to read any other language that might be significant, so that they can read things in the original language. So they were looking for a foreign language classics prof. They tried to get Reuchlin because he was the best. He said, "I'm sorry, I'm not free, I've got commitments for the foreseeable future, but I got a great nephew, and he's pretty bright, and while he's young, I think he can handle the job." And so Melanchthon came in August 1518. His job description said he was to teach the Greek language and Greek literature. He was 21 years old. So he began to teach. And he wasn't satisfied with just being a teacher, so he began to take a curriculum in Bible studies. And this is how he encountered Luther, as a student in Luther's classes on Bible. He got his Bachelor of Theology degree on September 9th, 1519, which was about a year later, which isn't bad. You know, to get a bachelor's degree that normally takes about 3 years, in a little less than 1 year while you're teaching full-time at the university, you know, not bad for a genius. He refused to study for any further degrees. Now, he claimed that this was out of modesty. There may be other reasons. And so he remained a layman for the rest of his life. Now, if he had continued to the master's degree and doctor's degree, undoubtedly there would have been pressure on him to, become a theologian in the church. But he remained a layman the rest of his life. And I suspect he was not unaware of the advantages of being a layman. First of all, the church couldn't discipline him because he was not under holy orders. Secondly, he could participate in lay confessional diets like Augsburg and others. The Diet of Augsburg, which produced the Augsburg Confession, which Melanchthon wrote, was a layman's meeting. So was the next one, which produced the Apology. The theologians weren't welcome. And that's the primary reason why Melanchthon wrote all the documents, because he was a layman. At the same time, he was very much at home in theology. I don't know how aware you were of the fact that the Augsburg Confession and the Apology, the Augsburg Confession, are not the offspring of laity and clergy. I'm not laity and clergy, of theologians and other clergy. But they're layman's documents, written by and signed by laity. I like to remind my theological colleagues of that every once in a while. All right, Luther was very much impressed by him, and he received permission from Stelpitz that Melanchthon be invited occasionally to offer a course in Bible. And he did once in a while. For instance, one of the first series that he gave on the Bible was on Paul's epistle to Titus. Just kind of interesting, you know, since it's a letter from the great apostle to a young clergyman giving him advice on how to be a clergyman. November 25th, 1520, when he was 23 years old, he married Katharina Krupp, K-R-A-P-P, not O-P-P, not the munitions family, but another family. Katharina Krupp, who was the daughter of the mayor of Wittenberg. You know, nothing like starting at the bottom and working up. So he married the mayor, the burgermeister's daughter. They had two sons and two daughters. One of his sons died at the age of two in 1527, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. Neither Philip nor his wife Catherine were very good at managing money, which oftentimes happens with geniuses. So they always had financial trouble. And finally, just simply to save their brilliant young professor, the university assigned a man named John Koch, who came from Heilbronn nearby, to handle their finances for them. So he became the manager of their finances, saw to it that they weren't broke all the time. From 1519 on, Melanchthon was involved with Luther in affairs having to do with the Reformation. Melanchthon taught Luther both Greek and Hebrew, and so it is thanks to Melanchthon that Luther was able to produce the great German Bible, because without his knowledge of Greek and Hebrew, which he had learned from Melanchthon, he never could have pulled it off. I suspect that if he had known Greek and Hebrew as well as Melanchthon did, he probably wouldn't have dared the task. But he knew just enough, you know, that he didn't realize how difficult a job it was, and so he did it. He advised Luther at the time of the Leipzig debate. In 1521, he wrote what may very well be his greatest book, called Loci Communes, Common Places. And it's a very interesting book. It's available in English, probably out of print now. But it's a very interesting book, because it's sort of like a little compendium of theological topics, but it's a veritable gold mine of theological ideas, and it is written on a level where the laity of the time could understand it. Luther read the thing and got excited about it, got so excited about it that he said, and this is true, "This book is so good that it ought to be in the canon. It ought to be a part of the Bible." Well, I suspect that there was a little bit of an exaggeration there. But it's a very well-written book, and it's a fascinating book. And what also is fascinating about it is the method which is used in the book, because it's the method of common places. And the method of common places is a method that Luther used and that Melanchthon used and was rather common at the time. And what it did was it approached theology from the standpoint not of producing a great big logical systematic structure or something of that sort, but you approached it topically, and you studied and expanded on a topic. The assumption being that most of theology is unknown to us. No way we could understand God. And so there's no way we can reduce God to a great system, to a summa. You can't get a sum of the knowledge of God. At the best, that we can have is insight here, insight there, insight there, insight there. You know, like the stars in the heaven. You don't have a solid white structure. You got a dot here, a dot there, a dot there, a dot there, and great big spaces around. This is the best we can do, is understand ideas. In a sense, if we shift over into logic, it's about like saying that the best that we can do is to understand concepts. We can't even get to the point of making propositional assertions where you put two concepts into relation to one another, much less put two propositions together and deduce a third one from them in a syllogism. And so it's a strongly non-system kind of way of doing theology. Okay. In 1521, Luther and following time, Luther was in the Wartburg. Melanchthon, Luther left Melanchthon in charge of theological matters at Wittenberg. It was during this period of time that Karl Stott, who was the ranking member of the theology faculty, and you remember who was that big conservative Thomist who kind of thought like Carl Cajetan, only not so brilliant. Karl Stott all of a sudden decides, with Luther gone, he must now assume the reins. And Karl Stott now goes from quiet, conservative defender of the past to fire-breathing, radical iconoclast. Opposite extreme from what he had been. You know, and he went around breaking stained glass windows and destroying statues and, you know, and marring wooden carvings and, you know, and, you know, we got to get things down to the basics, simple things and pure faith and, you know, can't have anything else. And he was really driving everybody up the wall. When Luther reappeared and put him in his place and took over again. But Luther blamed Melanchthon for not keeping Karl Stott in line. I think it was probably a very fair, unfair of him, because after all, Melanchthon was 24 years old. Karl Stott was probably in his late 50s. Melanchthon was one of the junior members of the faculty. Karl Stott was one of the original members of the faculty. And Melanchthon, you know, barely had his little finger in the theology department. He was in classics. So I think it was rather unfair of Luther to blame Melanchthon for the situation getting out of control. But what it did show very early in the game was that while Melanchthon was a brilliant original thinker and scholar, Melanchthon was not a good leader of men. He was not a good administrator of a department or of an area. Okay. Well, as a result of this, Luther and Melanchthon had a kind of falling out. Melanchthon went to return full-time to teaching classics. And there was a rift between the two of them until 1527, and it was at the time that Melanchthon's two-year-old son died, and Luther came to the Melanchthon house and comforted Melanchthon and his wife that the two of them were reconciled to one another. But they were never, ever as close to one another as they had been in the early years. And it's kind of unfortunate because each one of them had something to offer the other one, and I suspect that if they had been closer to one another, each one of them probably would have been better than they were. Okay, Melanchthon thought of himself not as a theologian, but as an educator, a teacher, and a theorist. He was the most popular prof at Wittenberg. Luther, in his most popular days, would draw 300 and 400 students to a lecture. At the same time, Melanchthon was drawing 800 to 1,000 to a lecture. He, in 1526, when he was 29 years old, started an experimental school at Nuremberg, a gymnasium, an upper-level educational institution. He invented the gymnasium, the high school. In 1528, he wrote the Saxon Articles of Visitation, which were rules and regulations for establishing a school system in Saxony, a system of public education in the province of Saxony. Luther wrote the preface to the book. He opposed the idea of scholastic education based on philosophic and theological bases, but instead proposed an education based on a study of the classics. So much a part of our education that we've taken for granted that it always was that way. But before Melanchthon, the basic orientation out of which you got your education was theology and philosophy. After Melanchthon, the basic orientation out of which you got your education was literature. And so it was built around a literature base. And you learn linguistic communication and grammar and how to write, and you learned classics in the literature of your day and classics in world literature, that kind of thing. You know, that's been a part of all of our education. Well, Melanchthon started that. For at least two centuries after Luther, Germany followed Melanchthon because Melanchthon proposed an Aristotelian logical base for education. For two centuries after Melanchthon, Germany went Aristotelian, and this is why, for the two centuries after Luther and Melanchthon, you have the basic method of theology is not commonplaces and rather simple treatises with profound study of basic ideas, but big systematic tomes. This is why we have an age of what we call Lutheran scholasticism for the next two centuries, because you write system structures operating with Aristotelian logic to resolve questions and issues that you where you can't get a scriptural answer, you deduce an answer. Okay. His idea for education in Saxony was that there should be three levels of education. All of this sounds so familiar, you know, we take it for granted. The first level would be elementary school, and everyone would go to elementary school. Then the more gifted students and the ones that wanted to continue would go to secondary school. And then the really most gifted students would go to the university. In the elementary school, on the lower level, apart from other studies, students would learn Latin so that on the upper level, they could read the Latin classics in the original and appreciate the Latin style, particularly that of Cicero. Well, we have not preserved that, but one thing that we have done, and that we didn't realize we had done up until about 20 years ago, and that is that we took English and we structured English grammar on a Latin base with a Latin model. And we tried to teach English as though it was Latin grammar. And so we did the same thing that Melanchthon was talking about, except that, you know, kids couldn't read Latin, and so they couldn't read the Latin classics. He had Greek and Hebrew taught on the upper level, and he originated something that has been debated for the last 15 years, giving grades for courses. On the secondary level, they called the gymnasium, and we get our word gymnasium from the fact that gymnasiums had rooms where you worked out, so they were called gymnasiums. One studied logic, rhetoric, literature, poetry, mathematics. Another brand new thing. Nobody studied mathematics. The two previous centuries were mathematically illiterate. Mathematics was the study of laity. You know, guys like Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus and other laity. the clergy and the theologians knew next to nothing about mathematics. Because you read Aristotle, Aristotle didn't know anything about mathematics. There's no work by Aristotle on mathematics. Plato did. And Luther and the young Melanchthon are in the Platonic tradition, and mathematics is an important kind of thing. You don't have logical system structures. And the later Melanchthon is in the Aristotelian tradition, and that's where the big structures and things come in. He suggested that on the university level, let the individual study in the classics. The University of Oxford is still, their classics curriculum is still on the Melanchthonian model. He reorganized the curricula for the University of Leipzig, the University of Tübingen, the University of Frankfurt, the University of Rostock, and the University of Heidelberg. So he became a university consultant, probably the first one in history, who helped universities to improve their curricula. He was also called in to help found four universities, Marburg, which became one of the great German universities, Königsberg, which produced two guys, one of whom you may have heard of, Christian Wolff and Immanuel Kant, the University of Jena, and the University of Erlangen. All four great universities. Melanchthon helped found them. You know, and that was just a minor part of what this man did in his life. All right, this was the time now where there had been a split between the Catholic Church and the followers of Luther, as a result of Luther being excommunicated without a trial or anything. And Melanchthon is one of a number of people who attempt to be reconcilers in the situation. Melanchthon was a kind of natural because he had close friends in both camps. And so, in addition to this, he was a member of the laity. The church couldn't touch him. And so he could travel around, whereas Luther couldn't. And so he participated in a number of theological conferences, as, for instance, the Diet of Speyer, the Marburg Colloquy, 1530, the Diet of Augsburg, which produced the Augsburg Confession. He wrote the Augsburg Confession, as we all know. He also participated in the background negotiations. And so he also was a kind of Henry Kissinger of the time, you know, with the private negotiations and the public events sort of thing happening. He participated in the negotiations at Smalcall during the 30s. And in 1536, he was influential in bringing all of South Germany to achieve a common agreement on the nature of the Lord's Supper, called the Wittenberg Concord. In 1541, he was at Regensburg, where settling some problems there. By 1540, it had sort of been taken for granted that Lutheranism was going to make it, and it was going to survive, and it was here to stay, and you might as well recognize it. Not only was this true, but much of the rest of Europe wanted the Reformation. They wanted to get out of the church, and they wanted to go Lutheran. In 1542 and 43, he was in Cologne and was unsuccessful in carrying the Reformation across the Rhine River. Actually, the Reformation never got over into France. It never got over into Switzerland, and it barely got over to England and then got wiped out. Not by their own Catholic Church, though, because it had long since been kicked out, but it was wiped out by Henry VIII and his successors. Well, under Bloody Mary, of course, there was a Roman Catholic kind of return. But Lutheranism never made it in England until the 20th century, and even now, you know, it's just hanging on by a thread, as is Anglicanism, for that matter.
Bonnie? Excuse me, Bill, you said it never got over in Switzerland?
It didn't get established in Switzerland. it didn't get established in France. I mean, it didn't achieve a power like it did elsewhere. It was successful east and north, northeast. You know, Scandinavian countries, Pomerania, Poland. It was successful south, but it was... Pardon? Switzerland. See, Calvinism took over Switzerland. Lutheranism didn't make it.
Oh, you said the Reformation. So
no, the Lutheran Reformation. Yeah, the Lutheran Reformation.
See,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so then the Huguenots, of course, were in France, but so they weren't Lutheran.
Yeah. Okay.
But Lutheranism made it northeast, the way you're looking, northeast and east and south, and of course south it got wiped out in the 30 Years' War. But west and southwest didn't make it. And, of course, didn't even penetrate Italy and hasn't to this day. Didn't penetrate Spain and hasn't to this day. You know, we really don't know why, but it, you know, every once in a while somebody, you know, like Carol Henderly will suggest that Lutheranism is a cold weather religion, you know, or something like that, that it needs snow in the winter to survive or something of that sort. You know, we don't really know, but at any rate, it just didn't make it. But there were inquiries from all over the place for Melanchthon to come and bring Lutheranism, including England. You know, the guys at Oxford wanted him to come. They offered him a distinguished service professorship at Oxford University if he'd only come and teach Lutheranism. Well, he couldn't make it. He was just too busy. He was invited to the University of Paris, which was, you know, the status university, couldn't make it. Well, at any rate, Lutheranism didn't get too far. Okay, after Luther's death, the situation began to change. Both the emperor and the pope thought that with Luther dead, the movement would start dying out and they could wipe out the remains of it. May 15th, 1548, there was a decision called the Augsburg Interim. And the emperor, Charles V, issued an edict that all members of the Holy Roman Empire were subject to the pope and the local bishop, which meant that all Lutherans were subject to their local bishop and through him to the pope. Melanchthon and others sought a compromise from him, and they reached a compromise which was then promulgated under the title of the Leipzig Interim, where there would be a kind of nominal relationship in that you could not be a legitimately ordained clergyman if a legitimate bishop of the church had not authorized your ordination. Now, this came about as a result of the belief that there had been an unbroken authority passed on from generation to generation from Christ to the apostles and so on to become ordained. And so consequently, if you were ordained by someone who was not a legitimately authorized bishop to ordain you, your ordination didn't count. It's interesting that today the Church of Sweden still has this kind of teaching, and I think it's one of the things that they hold up against the Norwegians, and that is that their bishops are in that long tradition and the Norwegian bishops aren't. I remember some years ago a pastor in my synod made a trip to Sweden to be ordained just so that he could say he had been legitimately ordained in the long tradition dating back to Christ and his apostles. Well, Melanchthon agreed to this, that bishops could have the authority over Lutheran clergymen to ordain them, and that the Lutheran Church would follow Roman ceremonial laws about fasting and things of that sort. Now, he also found himself stuck with a sort of Romanish doctrine of conversion, kind of cooperative doctrine of conversion, which he explicitly repudiated in 1556. Well, during these years, He was invited to come to England, to France, to Denmark, to Poland. He was offered professorships also in Hungary, Greece, Italy. He remained in Wittenberg because he felt that if he left Germany, the Reformation might be wiped out. From this point on, the Lutheran Reformation began to disintegrate as four or five different factions began to form. And it's from this time, for a number of years, that we have some rather unfortunate correspondence by Melanchthon, where Melanchthon reflects rather unfavorably on Luther in his relationship to Luther. For instance, he wrote a letter to a Roman Catholic friend of his in 1548, and the friend published it immediately. I used to have an unfortunate slavery to Luther. In many instances, he was guided by his quarrelsome mood rather than his intelligence. And as a result, it didn't help his reputation or the public welfare. Well, this was immediately published. Luther's closest friend tells the truth about Luther. Embarrassing. In 1557, the last time that he tried to bring about Catholic and Lutheran reconciliation, and this was at Worms. And just when he thought he was on the point of beginning to find a common ground for agreement, he discovered that the Lutherans were arguing with one another about what they believed. They didn't even have a common base themselves. And so he gave up. As a young man in his association with Luther, there is good reason to believe that he reached certain conclusions, theological conclusions, before Luther did and taught them to Luther. For instance, the notion of forensic justification, that justification is a legal act on the part of God, that God justifies us not because we are just, but he declares us just even when we aren't, as a forensic decision. The doctrine of imputed righteousness, that the righteousness of Christ is imputed to us, that we don't have it ourselves. The distinction between law and gospel that we've always attributed to Luther. The Lutheran doctrine of predestination. The Lutheran doctrine of sola scriptura. And position of criticism of transubstantiation. From 1531 on, he became increasingly Aristotelian. I think that what probably triggered this off was the Peasants' War. If you read things written by Melanchthon, prior to the Peasants' War, I think you find the emphasis on the freedom of the Christian man even more pronounced in Melanchthon than in Luther. You know, we've been, for the bicentennial of the country, this year we've been using Luther's commentary on Galatians, you know, as our theological book on the freedom of the Christian. There's some things which Melanchthon wrote which have an even greater emphasis on the freedom of the Christian man. And then came the Peasants' Revolt. And Melanchthon was shocked at the excesses that went on. Now bear in mind that all of his life, Melanchthon was a university man. He was an academic, and he lived in the academic world. He didn't live in the business world. You know, he couldn't handle his own finances. He did not live in the political world. He never was involved in a war. He lived in this rarefied academic community. And he was shocked at how the peasants behaved, and he came to the conclusion that they were incapable of freedom. And so he became increasingly authoritarian, and there's good reason to believe that he is the one who is responsible in the Lutheran Church for the doctrine of the third use of the law. Namely, that the law of God must be applied to Christians to keep them in line, and without the law, Christians will just go crazy. And they will do all kinds of wild things. So they are still under the law, and they must be compelled to obey the law. And it was probably as a result of what he saw happening in the peasants' war that the law has an ethical use to keep Christian people in line so they don't go to excess. We cannot trust the gospel to motivate them. He reacted to Zwingli's doctrine of complete predestination by gradually moving more and more in the direction of complete human freedom, which is a kind of contradiction to the previous point. But he did, and he eventually ended up in argument with Luther on the doctrine of human freedom or human bondage. His influence was most strongly apparent in that section of the Formula of Concord, even though by the time the Formula of Concord was written, he was dead. In 1532, he was beginning to talk in this way: there are three causes operating with one another in conversion. The Holy Spirit at work on the heart, the Word of God having an effect on our intellect, and human assent. Well, you got synergism going at that point. In 1559, he wrote to a friend of his, "I never accepted Luther's ideas because they were usually Stoic determinism or Manichaean delirium." 1559. Lutherans themselves were lucky that they weren't getting persecuted, because they were involved in a series of arguments on all sorts of doctrines for a great many years, which finally did not get resolved until 1580 in the Formula of Concord. But that was 20 years after Melanchthon died. As Melanchthon got to his last years, on every side it appeared that everything that he and Luther had worked for was falling apart. Lutherans were fighting against Lutherans. They were dividing up into all kinds of factions and schisms. On April 19th, 1560, he died a broken-hearted and very lonely man. And I'm sure he had come to the conclusion that everything he and Luther had worked for was over, and he had enough conceit to believe that it would certainly be over as soon as he was dead. Now, he was 63 years old, and I think another one of the great ironies of the Reformation is, if you go to Wittenberg and you go into the castle church and you look down there by the pulpit, you will see Martin Luther is buried, and right next to him is Philip Melanchthon. And for so many years of their professional career, they just were moving apart from one another, and Melanchthon continued to move apart from Luther after Luther was dead. He wrote a great many books. He wrote very well in all areas of human knowledge, and there haven't been many that could do that. But he's probably, his greatest impact in Central Europe was not his theological work, but his educational ideas and his system of education, which had really not that much to do with the Reformation. Well, that's Philip Melanchthon, and tomorrow we'll talk about the youngest of them all, Charles V.